Blog Talk Radio.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. In 1969, the body of a young woman was discovered in the woods of Renton, rocking the communities along Puget Sound. Three more brutal murders followed, drawing the attention of multiple police agencies as they tried to piece together the meager clues left behind. The seemingly unrelated cases challenged detectives, who struggled to realize they were all connected to one man, Gary Jean Grant. Before the term serial killer was even coined, Grant stalked his prey, destroying lives and families while walking unseen among the masses. Decades later, his crimes have all but been forgotten. Join author and homicide investigator Cloyd Steiger as he uncovers the story of the murderer who slipped through the cracks of history. The book that we're featuring this evening is Seattle's Forgotten Serial Killer, Gary Jean Grant, with my special guest, retired homicide detective and author, Cloyd Steiger. Welcome to the program, and thank you very much for this interview, Cloyd Steiger.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Thank you very much. Tell our audience a little bit about your background. I just mentioned that you were a homicide detective. Tell us a little bit about your background and the job that after you retired from homicide division, what job you worked at and had some relation to this case.
Yeah, I spent 36 years with the Seattle Police Department, and the last 22 of those years I was a homicide detective, so I investigated hundreds of murders, everything from the gangbanger on the corner to serial killers, mass shooters, active shooters, domestic terrorism. And I retired in 2016, and I went to work for the Washington State Attorney General Homicide Investigation Tracking System. That's a system that was set up back in the days. It was actually originated in Bundy days and then in the Green River days because of agencies not having information across jurisdictional lines. And Bob Keppel, who's well known in the murder industry, set this thing up.
Right.
And he was the chief criminal investigator at that time. And that's the position I have now as the chief criminal investigator. So I run that unit, and I supervise the investigators and analysts across the state. We track every murder that happens in the state and also in Oregon and Montana. But we also consult with agencies, especially small agencies that just don't handle that many murders and don't know what to do. We offer them expertise and also resources if they need it. And so that's what I do, but it's a great job as a retirement job because it's 8 o'clock in the morning to 4 in the afternoon every day. I know what time I'm going home every day, and they never call me at 1:30 in the morning. So that's the difference in this is my old
one. Now, you're an author of another book called The View from Inside the Yellow Tape, and this is a true crime, what they consider a true crime memoir. Tell us a little bit about this, and you were talking to a reader of this book one day, and he mentioned something to you. So tell us a little bit about this book and the success of this book, and then what it led to in terms of this project.
Yeah, so I wrote, people would always ask me, non-police people that I knew, to tell them about my work, and I'd tell them things, and they'd just be fascinated. I'm talking about a day at work like anybody else, and I look at them, and their mouths are hanging open, and I keep hearing, you got to write a book, yeah. So when I was getting close to retiring, I just started toying around with the idea, and then I just started writing stuff down, and before you knew it, I had a book. I published it through Amazon, and it actually took off really well. I mean, I got a lot of sales, a lot of interviews in the news, a lot of media coverage, a lot of podcasts, and then I did advertising through Amazon. But it's sold pretty well. It's consistently sold. It's been out in a couple of years. And so I one day I get an email from some guy that has read the book, and he said, "Hey, what do you know about Gary Grant? He was a guy killing kids and people in Renton in the late 60s, early 70s. And, you know, I'm kind of a student of serial killers, especially ones from this region, and there are many of them. But I had never heard of Gary Grant. So I was kind of surprised by that. And my main interest was for this job that I have now, because to put that case in the database. So I had one of my analysts call the Renton Police Department, and they said, "Well, no, we don't really have it. We have his name here, but not much." And then they called the King County Sheriff, who also handled some of the cases. They didn't have much. So I called the King County Prosecutor's Office and to the area, the Prosecutor's Office that handles all the murders, and the paralegal there. And I said, "Hey, do you have a case on this guy or a court file?" And she said, "Let me check. I'll get back to you." And a few days later, she called and said, "Yeah, we have it. Can I borrow it?" She said, "Sure." So I went down and got it. And it was thousands of pages. And I just scanned the entire case file, again, to put it in our database of all these murders. Because we want to have all serial murders, right? We have every murder from about 1983 forward. Going backward, we have select murders that we know about, any unsolved involving especially female victims are in our database that we know about, and any serial killings we hear about. But so that's what happened. And so I had it all, and I was reading through it. And literally, I'm driving down the road, and my phone rings, and it's people from History Press, and they said, that's a publishing company, they said, "Hey, we saw you wrote that book, that homicide book. It's doing pretty well. You sold quite a few copies." I said, "Yeah, I have." And they go, "We're looking for true crime, semi-historic, like 20 or 30 years minimum old, that would be interesting. Do you have any cases like that you know of?" And I'm thinking, are you kidding me? I just read this case. So I said, "Oh yeah, I have something in mind." And so they said, they emailed me some slips and filled out a proposal. The only thing they were nervous about was that little kids were involved in this, which is always it's hard to write about that. So that was their only hitch. But finally they said, "No, write the book." So I did.
No, fantastic. You talk about in the introduction that you had particularly some help because, you know, by the time something like this happens 30 years later, 20, 30 years later, some people are passed away. So, just briefly, tell us where you did get some incredible cooperation from people that were still living that were connected to the case.
Yeah, well, it started with I was hunting down, trying to find detectives who worked on it, and most of them, a lot of them had passed away. But I happened to know the mayor of the town of Renton, and so I sent him an email. "Hey, listen, I'm looking into this case. You know anybody? Is anybody still around?" And he hooked me up with a city councilman that was a retired Renton policeman that was on the department back then. And then I went to his house and met him, and he called this guy. He gave me all these guys that were still alive that worked on the case. So I started talking to them and getting their information. The judge in the case, his son was a prosecutor that I knew. And I presumed his dad was gone, but I said, "Hey, your dad worked on this case." And then he goes, "You want to talk to him about it? He's still around." I said, "You're kidding." So he's in his 90s. Yeah. I got a hold of him. Yeah. The elected prosecutor at the time, I got a hold of him, and he was real cooperative. And then one of the other prosecutors in the case was somebody I knew because he was still working when I was working, and I talked to him. And then, as a matter of fact, that was all I could find. And then just today, I got an email from one of the defense attorneys that I didn't know was still alive. I said, "Man, I wish I'd have got this email from you before I wrote the book, because he'd have been another good resource." Yeah, I'm going to talk to him later. But so that's I just was sniffing around wherever I could get it, talking to people. And because of the events that went on in this case, there are a lot of twists and turns that people remembered it really well, and a couple of them. Well, one of the prosecutors was no longer alive. He just died a year before. But his son, who was himself a former prosecutor, is now a private attorney, knew all about this case because his dad talked to him all the time about it, because it really bothered him, because these 2 6-year-old boys that were some of the victims, this guy I was talking to, the attorney now, was 6 when it happened, and his dad was prosecuting the case, and he said it really affected him. And when he himself became a prosecutor, they talked about this case a lot. And then he was a great resource. So, like I said, you got to just be a detective, right? Hunt down your witnesses and talk to them. That's what I did.
Right. Now, you describe, for those people that didn't live in 1969 and so many years have passed, about the turbulent time it was in America. Richard Nixon was his first year of presidency. There was the protest on the streets in America over the Vietnam War. There was the Apollo 11 moon landing. And the previous summer, people were shocked, to say the least, by the murders by the Charles Manson cult, as you write.
Yeah.
And this was a few years before Ted Bundy stalked women in the local area. And the term serial killer, as we said in the introduction, was not yet in the American lexicon. Take us to Renton, Washington. You say it was 100,000 people in 2019, but in 1969 it was a small place. Tell us where Renton is situated, and then tell us about December 16th, 1969, and a guy named Edward Stewart is doing some fishing.
Right. So, well, Renton is about 11 miles southeast of downtown Seattle. That's the whole east side of Seattle, border of the Seattle on the east side is Lake Washington, which is a huge lake that runs from north of the city all the way down to south of the city. And Renton is at the south tip of Lake Washington. There's a river called the Cedar River that dumps into Lake Washington. And Renton is there. The only thing Renton is known for really is that Jimi Hendrix is buried there in a cemetery.
Right.
He's the most famous. So he, there's a Boeing plant in Renton. That's their biggest employer. In 1969, the population was about 10,000, but the Boeing plant there was putting out bombers, B-29s during World War II. And then after the war ended, it kind of switched over to 707s. And then the area grew and grew and grew. Like you said, it's over 100,000 now. And actually the 737 MAX is being built at the Renton plant now, or was. Mm-hmm. So that's the history of Renton. It's grown. It's like anything else. It was a small town with a small town feel then, but now it's the bosom of suburbia, shopping malls and all that stuff, and a lot of people. And well, the police department at that time was only about 40 people, the whole police department, and they had five detectives. And so, yeah, it was a very small operation. They had very few murders in Renton. They'd go 3, 4, 5 years without a single murder. And when it did happen, it was usually a bar fight that got out of control, or, what we used to call the smoking gun murders. It's not a whodunit.
Right.
Not everybody knew who did it. Yeah. And that's what their only experience of murders. So anyway, on that December day in 1969, this guy is walking down to the river because he wants to go fishing that afternoon. He's checking the conditions. And there's a muddy trail that at that time went along the west side of the riverbank. And he was taking that, and when he went around a corner, he saw, of course, what they always think, a mannequin laying on the ground. But as he got closer, he realized it wasn't a mannequin at all. It was a woman, and she was dead and nude. So he was kind of shocked and turned around and ran back. And he ran into a buddy of his on the way back, and he told him what he saw. And they came back, and the guy looked at it to make sure, and then they went and called the police. And that's how this whole case started. So the police came, obviously. They didn't... They had no idea who this woman was. They had no idea what was going on. But there were some papers, backpack laying nearby. They had some papers in it, like school papers and a name. And so they looked at the papers and figured out the name was Carol Erickson on the papers. Now, they didn't know if that was really this person. She was on her back at that point. Her hands were over her head. She had a sweater on that was like mostly pulled up, exposing her breasts, and she was nude from the way the rest of her body was nude on the way down. So when the medical examiner got there and they rolled the body, they saw she had one single stab wound to the center of her back, and that she had been also strangled with her shoelaces. So that's what they had. They finally identified her as Carol Erickson by talking to friends and family. And it ended up that Carol was a student at a local vocational school up the hill. She was 19 years old. Just up the top of the hill from where she was, there was a vocational school. And she was taking culinary arts there. And she lived in an apartment with a friend right downtown, not too far from where she was found. And she was she'd walked to the library the night before to study for some tests she had coming up in her class. And instead of taking the city streets, she would walk this path down the river, and people told her know, when she went there, it was light and it was okay. But people said, yeah, you shouldn't walk down there. It's dark. But she just blew them off. You know, oh, no, it's fine. But she, so she was apparently on her way back because she'd been to the library. She was on her way back when she was attacked from behind. And of course, like everything else, you get whenever there's a whodunit murder, especially if you've never done those types, you're spinning your wheels. You're going down all kinds of these rabbit holes that have nothing at all to do with your case. And that's what happened in this case. They spent, you know, weeks going down rabbit holes. Nothing solid ever happened, and it kind of just was petering out.
Who are the, you introduced two detectives that are important to the story, Detective Don Dashnia and Wally Hume.
Right.
You also talk about another person that's in the story reoccurring is Dr. Gail Wilson, who's the medical examiner. What does she find that they don't ascertain at the crime scene, these detectives? What does she find out in this medical examination of Carol
Well,
Erickson?
Actually, Dr. Wilson is a man. It's Gail, like the man.
Oh,
Gail.
Sorry.
Well, they find out when Dr. Wilson, first of all, he was a long-time medical examiner. I mean, this was in 1969. When I was still working, I looked into a murder from 1936 of a little girl, and I pulled that file out, and he did the autopsy in that case. And then since I've been working at HITS now, I looked at a 1977 case. And he did the autopsy on that. So, I mean, he was a long-time medical examiner. But he determined that Carol had been – the fatal wound was a stab to her back that had punctured her heart and killed her almost instantly. She was also strangled either paramortem, like at the moment of death, or postmortem with her shoelaces, and she had been sexually assaulted. That's what he found.
So how do they undertake to investigate this – and what does it lead to?
Well, they did a lot of work. I mean, it didn't lead to anything, though. That's the thing, because they didn't have any. I tell people all the time that detectives of that era had basically a hammer and a saw, where I have an entire construction company with power tools at my disposal today, as far as the science that's available. So they had nothing, no tools, and they didn't, unless you got a witness or somebody, you know, they went to the library and talked to everybody, put things in the paper. Were you at the library on Monday night? Did you see this girl there? And, you know, they got a couple of leads about creepy guys are hanging out by the front. But, you know, like most of those leads, they just kind of peter out. They could never figure anything out. So this case kind of just slowly faded in activity because they didn't have much more to go on, and it just kind of went cold in the first few months.
Right. They even talk about detectives making a plea to the public through the newspaper Seattle Times. You talk about September 19th, 1970, so maybe 9 months later, is still in Renton, a girl named Joanne Marie Zuloff, a 17-year-old. Tell us about what happens with her.
Okay, actually, at that time, her address was in unincorporated King County, just outside the Renton city limits. It was a Renton mailing address, and today it is in the city of Renton. But she was home with her. She lived there with her parents and sister, and her parents had been gone all day, and then they came home, and they were going to make dinner, and she said, I'm going to go for a walk. I'll be back in 20 minutes. And so she left the house, and at like about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, walked out of her house. A neighbor outside saw her walk past him, and into there's a big wooded area, huge acres and acres of woods right by their house. And she went down the trail like she did a lot when she walked. She just didn't come home. And so, of course, her parents started worrying about her, and then they got in the car, were driving around, calling all her friends. Have you seen Joanne? Has anybody seen Joanne? You know, and nobody saw her. And they're freaking out. They finally, late, at 8 o'clock in the evening, they called the King County Sheriff's Office to handle that area. And of course, the dispatcher said, well, you know, let's just wait and see if she comes back. You know, she kind of blew it off a little bit, which was, in retrospect, was kind of a mistake. But, you know, she'll probably be back. He's just, you know, she's a 17-year-old girl, and maybe she ran away. And she didn't go. So the next morning, you know, the parents, of course, are panicky all night long because she's not a runaway. This is not anything she would do. And so the next morning, she coincidentally also went to the same vocational school as Carol Erickson. They didn't know evidence they knew each other. They didn't take the same classes. But So she went to that school to talk to her friend to see if she showed up at school. Does anybody know where she is? Finally, in the afternoon, they called the police again, and a sheriff's deputy, who was pretty sharp, came out. And he looked at this. He goes, oh, I don't like this at all. And so he called his supervisor and says, yeah, this is not a runaway. We need to get a search going right now. So they started a high-level search. They brought in search and rescue people and everything, and they started searching the area with dogs. So about midnight that night, one of the dog handlers calls up, says, come down here. So they go down there, and on this trail, about 30 feet away in the brush, is the nude body of Joanne Zuloff. She'd been strangled to death, apparently hit in the head with a hard object also, but she also was nude, and it was kind of the same story as Carol, although again, this is the sheriff's, not the city police. And they're more experienced because they have a lot more area, but to their credit, early on, one of the detectives at the sheriff's office says, you know, Renton had that case a few months ago. We should talk to them and compare notes. And so they did. But, you know, they didn't have anything to go on. Yeah, it's very similar, but who knows? And so they started, again, another murder investigation that went down a bunch of rabbit holes and they went all over the place, and nothing they were doing had anything to do with the case because you don't know it at the time. But they got, you know, everybody in the world says this guy did it and that guy did it, and you go chasing all these leads, and none of them panned out. And that one, same thing, it started just petering out.
With this one, though, they have a composite drawing because of from a witness, so that composite is created.
Well, that would happen. Yeah, that what happened with the composite is when the parents were driving around, they were at one point down the street and they saw a guy come out of the woods, and they looked at him, and that's what they drew the composite of, this guy they saw come out of the woods. So they did. They put that in the paper, and anybody know this guy? And it came up with a couple leads, but nothing that was really. No, nothing that ended up getting helping them solve the case. But as it ends up, none of those leads they got had anything to do with this case. They didn't know it at the time, of course. But, so there was a little bit more. They had more resources at their disposal because they were a much larger department. You know, that was, I don't know how big the sheriff's office is, but a much larger department. That's the sheriff's office to handle Seattle, you know, around the Seattle area, King County. So, you know, it's a bigger department, but the same thing, though. They worked on it for months and tracked things down, but didn't come up with anything.
You take us to April 1971. Bradley Lyons, 6-year-old, and is supposed to meet with his friend. Tell us this story about a little quiet neighborhood and these two 6-year-old boys on their bicycles.
Yeah, so again, in April of the next year, they were these kids lived where they lived at that time was unincorporated King County, not in the city of Renton, but it had a Renton address. And it was a Tuesday, and normally would there be school, but it was one of those teachers' workshop days or something when everybody has a day off and the teachers just work in the school. And so Brad Lyons and Scott Andrews, they were good friends, lived nearby in the neighborhood, and, you know, after they each one of them ran some errands with his mom in the morning, and then they went out to play, and they were playing outside, and, you know, other neighborhood kids were outside. And one of the mothers said that they saw the boys in the back in their backyard, and they came in, asked for cookies, and brought all his friends cookies, and they were playing and everything. And about a while later, she has to go somewhere, so she looks out and she sees her younger son. That's the neighborhood kids, but she doesn't see her oldest son. And she goes, is Brad out there? And she goes, well, he and Scott are playing in the woods, because there's, again, a huge wooded area right next to where they live. And so,
Right. Okay,
she didn't think anything of it. They'd play in the woods all the time. And this is, you know, nothing ever happened up there. This wasn't a bad neighborhood. She didn't think anything of it at all. So they went about their business. But later on, you know, kids didn't come back. And then so they were getting obviously very concerned. And by it's starting to get dark, now they're going to call the police because, you know, these 6-year-old kids are gone and it's after dark. And, of course, when you have 2 6-year-old kids like that, again, it was the King County Sheriff's Office that initially responded. And they didn't hesitate for a minute. You know, they started doing this search. But they were, you know, it was the wooded area where these kids went into. I don't know how many acres it was, but it was probably hundreds of acres. It was a big forested area. And so, you know, it took a lot, and they searched and searched. And then the plea went out that these kids are missing. You know, have you seen these kids? And the river, the Cedar River, the same one that Carol Erickson was found murdered by downriver at that point, it kind of winds through there, and everybody was fearful that the kids had fallen in the river and gotten washed
right.
away. So, and that's what everybody feared. But it went on for 2 or 3 days, and they didn't find these kids. And then one day, finally on the third day, one of the volunteers searching is walking through a wooded area, and he just sees something out of the corner of his eye. He looks over, and he sees a tuft of blonde hair, and there's a pile of leaves and debris. And he walks over and looks, and he sees the other kid's hair, and he goes, "Oh my gosh!" He runs and gets the police, and they find out that they're there. And then, but when they get there, and they find where they are, now they're actually in the city of Renton, so it's back to the Renton Police Department.
Right.
With the county helping them, but it's like, these kids have been murdered, and they were both nude. They were laid side by side. One of them had been stabbed to death, and the other had like a blinds cord wrapped around his neck and tied. And so, and they were again both nude, and they again had no idea who did this. It was it was a big case. It was, first of all, it was the Renton city of Renton had never had a double murder in their history at that point. Never. And that double murder of children. It was the worst murder in Renton history to that point.
You talk about when they called the Renton police, now Detectives Dashnia, Hubner, Wally Hume, Detectives Caldwell, Henry, and Pavone.
Phelan.
Those guys
yeah.
all arrive at the scene, and Sergeant Phelan as well.
Right.
You say that the killer does something quite unusual, and it's says something psychologically about the killer and his motivations.
Are you talking about what, he covers their faces and stuff?
Well, you talked about,
sure, what you're talking
the
about.
Body being covered and what that really
oh,
meant
yeah, yeah.
psychologically.
Yeah, well, because sometimes, because, you know, of course, they didn't know this as the other girls. The other girls were not covered. They were both dragged. Both those girls were dragged from where they were originally assaulted to where they were found. But these kids, yeah, they were covered and their face was covered, which, kind of, you know, anytime you have a covered face, it's like a psychological undoing. The person doesn't want the victim to look at them. And I didn't do this, you know, I'm covering you up. You don't really exist. You know, I can't see you, so you don't really exist. And that's something that tells you in these type of things, the psychological undoing, or the, you know, the person does something and then is like, freaked out that they did it. That's kind of what it shows. You know, whenever you see somebody's face covered, or, you know, there's things you look for in a murder scene. If you have a scene where there's attacks to the face, like stab wounds to the face or shooting in the face, that's a personal attack. That means the person either personally knew this person or was transposing someone they did know for this person, you know, if they're crazy. So that's what you look for in that. And you also look for faces covered, head turned intentionally of a victim away from where the suspect would have been. And that tells you that, you know, it's an undoing or a psychological undoing by the killer.
What about the stab wounds to Scott Andrews?
Yeah, Scott was stabbed multiple times in the chest, very quickly. He was, and he also had he'd been punched in the face. He had a little mark on his face, like he'd been hit. And so, it was a blitz attack, you know. And then the other little boy, again, he'd been strangled with a cord from a set of blinds that were tied around his neck, and that's how he died.
What about any kind of prints, shoe prints, fingerprints?
Oh yeah, right next to the body, they found a tennis shoe print. It was very silty dirt there. And he got a very clear tennis shoe print, and it looked like like an athletic shoe that were common at that time. But they did a lot to preserve it. They photographed it, they cast it in plaster Paris, and that later became a very key point of evidence in this case.
What about the murder weapon? What about the search for a possible murder weapon? How did that turn out?
Well, a few days later, they got the idea to go back with dogs and try to search the area for the weapon. They'd done this at Carol Erickson's also, but didn't find the knife. So they did it again, and they went through the not too far away in the brush, they found a knife, and it was consistent with the wounds that were on the victim. So they, obviously seized that right away and took it right to the crime lab, immediately to the crime lab, to start examining it.
Right.
In the meantime, this thing with the
Sorry, I interrupted.
I'm sorry. Yeah, I just said, in the meantime, this other big lead that came out between actually finding the boys and finding the knife, there was a guy walking into the hospital that kind of had a big effect on this case.
Absolutely. Let's use this as, just as an opportunity to break for a couple commercials. We'll be right back after these messages. Hi, we're back. We were just talking about what was interesting in this case right after these boys were found, these 2 6-year-old boys were found, and this some evidence at this crime scene that there was somebody reported to be walking at the hospital. Tell us what happens, person wandering and acting odd at the hospital.
Okay, well, this first person, Valley Medical Center, that's what it's called now, Valley Medical Center, it was Valley General Hospital back then, is a hospital in the city of Renton. And this young girl, 19-year-old, was working at the admission desk in the ER. And this guy comes in, he just sits down in the waiting area, doesn't say anything. And she watches him for a minute, she goes over there and says, "Can I help you?" And he's like, really odd, he won't talk to her. And he just starts kind of talking nonsensically. So she's like, didn't know what's going on. She goes to get the charge nurse, and she comes out, and he starts telling her that he has these problems. He needs to go to the hospital every now and then. So she takes him back into the ER, and he says, and gets the doctor, the ER doctor. And one of the things this guy says is, "I have an urge to hurt children. I just feel like I could hurt children." And they think right. That's odd, you know. But they give him a Thorazine shot and put him in the room there and everything, and don't think anything of it, really. I mean, he's just a psych patient, and he's obviously got issues. So that's what happens at that point. A couple days later, now, that same doctor, it ends up that guy walked into the hospital the same day the boys went missing, okay? So that same
right.
doctor was at home a couple days later, and he has a young daughter, and his wife picking the daughter up for school, and she goes, "You know, the two little boys are still missing. I wonder what happened to them." And then he'd heard about it, but he hadn't paid much attention. He starts listening, like, what's going on? And the kids, "Oh yeah." And he goes, and he starts thinking about this patient that on Tuesday, the day the kids went missing, this patient came into his hospital saying he had the surgery to hurt children. And he kind of went, "Oh my God, I wonder if he has anything to do with this." But he didn't know if he could tell anybody because of the doctor-patient privilege. So he called the hospital and got a hold of the hospital's lawyers, and they discussed it, and they found an exception, a battered child exception, to the doctor-patient privilege. And so they said, "You can call the police." So he called the police. And when the detectives got the message that this doctor was calling, they were standing over the bodies of Scott Andrews and Bradley Lyons. It's like, oh my God. So they rush over, two detectives, one King County detective and one Renton detective, go over to the hospital, and they start talking to this doctor, find out what's going on. And then they go in and they talk to this guy, John Chance. And, and they start asking him some questions, and he's kind of, a little out of it. And they ask him if he hurt any kids. He goes, "Well, I can't imagine that I did. I don't remember," that type of thing. So they decide they're going to take him downtown to Seattle to Harborview, which is the big trauma center, but it's also got a big psych ward. And so we're going to take you to Harborview. So they take him to Harborview, and we're going to come back tomorrow and talk. Okay. So they drop him off at Harborview, and there's some issues about whether Harborview will keep him, but they end up keeping him for a while. They go back down there the next day, and they start questioning him. And he wants to tell them all about this murder. And he tells them that he took these kids and he did this. And he starts describing all this detail, and he covered them up. And they're like, oh my gosh. So they take him out and they drive him down to the scene where the boys, show us where the boys are found. And he starts tromping through the brush, and he can't find anything. And he's doing all this stuff, but he knows all this stuff. So that this is our guy, right? Mm-hmm. So they have a prosecutor. They arrest him for the murder because he's told them all about it and confessed to them. Well, ends up later, I'll tell you how he knew all this stuff. But they put him in jail, and a couple days later, he's actually charged with the murder of the two boys. And the mistake the police made, and this was a rookie mistake by them, but by not knowing about murders that much, not by the detectives, but by the administration, is when they released things, they told the media everything that happened.
Yeah.
So if you go back to the newspapers from that day, you can see the entire thing described. So there's no doubt that this guy, John Chance, got a newspaper and read the account and then just regurgitated what he read in the paper to the detectives. I mean, he may have really, because then he went back and forth. Yeah, I did it. No, I didn't do it. So, I mean, he was absolutely, you know, had real sanity issues. I mean, he was like a, but he wasn't stupid. I mean, he had like an advanced degree from Columbia University and had been a teacher, but he just had all these mental issues that caused all these problems. So anyway, he gets charged. And so then he's in jail for the murder. There's big news. We got the guy that killed the kids. Well, that's when they decide to go search for that knife. I mean, they're already in the process, but that's the knife is found after that. They send it to the crime lab. They take the crime lab, the guy, Kay Sweeney, who I actually know from when I worked, he was still there for a long time. He's examining the knife, and it's got like black electrical tape all over the hilt. So he unwinds the electrical tape, trying to see if he can get fingerprints off of it. When he gets to the bottom, he sees there's a name etched into the knife. And he calls him up, hey, there's a name etched in this knife. He goes, you're kidding me. So they get the information, they figure out who this guy is. Well, they find out this guy is a young man who's in the Marine Corps. He's in basic training down in San Diego. And he was in basic training when this murder happened. So, but his parents say he's coming home like in 2 days. His basic's over with. And I'll bring him in for an interview. So they do. And they bring him in for an interview. And they start talking about this knife. He goes, yeah, I remember that knife. And he starts telling him where he bought it and everything. And he etched my name in that. And he goes, what happened to the knife? He goes, well, I sold it to my friend so-and-so, you know. And they go, where's he at? And he goes, well, he's somewhere. And he goes, but I know he doesn't have it anymore because he gave it to this other kid. And they go, how do you know that? He told me he gave it to this other kid. And who's this kid? And it's some 14-year-old boy that he gave the knife to. So they go to this kid's school, pull him out of class, start interviewing him. And he says, yeah, I had that knife. And he goes, yeah, I used it. And he goes, he lived in a trailer park in Renton. Right along Lake Washington. It's kind of ironic because it was like a single wide trailer park back then, but $1 million condos at that site right now. But he said, I was out and I was with my buddy in his truck, and I got out and I forgot the knife in his truck. And they go, well, who's your buddy? He goes, Gary Grant. He lives in the same trailer court as me. So they start looking into Gary Grant, and he goes, yeah, but I asked Gary to give me the knife back. But he said his dad found it in the truck and put it in his bedroom. And Gary says, I can't go in his bedroom and get it. So they start looking into this Grant guy. They find out that his dad, Glenn Grant, was at one time a Pierce County sheriff, which is the county down by Tacoma. But then now he's working as a private security guard, like in a neighborhood patrol thing. And they start thinking, you know, well, first of all, they were suspicious of John Chance. They weren't convinced that John Chance really did it, these detectives. They said, you know, he would just say anything you wanted him to say. So that's why they kept investigating it, to their credit. They didn't stop because they thought they had a guy. They kept investigating. And so they're thinking that the dad, because he's a residential security guard, he has a car. He said, this kid probably would get in the car with him thinking he's a policeman. So let's go talk to him. So they go to the trailer they live in, and they're talking to the dad, and the mom is there, and Gary isn't there. And so they start talking, asking about the knife, and Glenn Grant says, I don't know anything about any knife. He says, you didn't find a knife in your truck? He goes, no, I didn't find a knife in my truck. I don't know anything about any knife. So as they're talking, Gary pulls up in the truck. Now, here's Gary. So one of the detectives, Jim Phelan, he's a sergeant. Let me go out here and talk to him. So he goes out there and he goes, hey, Gary, how you doing? I'm Renton Police. And he says, yeah, we're just talking to your dad in there. Why don't you stay out here with me? Why don't you have a seat in my car? So Gary says, okay. And he goes to get in the car. And when Jim sees him get in the car, the bottom of his shoe is exposed. And he goes, that's the same shoe print I saw at the murder victims. I mean, that matches the pattern. So he goes in, he gets Wally Hume, the other detective, says, we got to get out of here. He goes, what? Come on, let's go. And long story short, they get him in the car, and they take Gary down to Renton, to the police department. And, you know, they're talking to him, and they say, hey, Gary, do you mind if we look at your shoes? And no, he gives them the shoes. And then Phelan goes out and goes to the guy that handles the evidence and gives me that plaster cast, you know. And so they get the plaster cast, and they look, and the shoe's the exact same pattern.
Right.
That doesn't mean, of course, that it's the same shoe, because thousands of those shoes are sold, right? But it is interesting. There are no individual traits. Go ahead. Do you have a question?
You also talk about that this conversation, this confession, is being recorded the whole time, but unbeknownst to these detectives, I believe.
Yeah, well, that actually happened a little later. Yeah, that happened a little later, because first of all, they have to take him down. He hasn't confessed anything yet, but he will soon. So they decide they want to put him on a polygraph machine. Okay, so they didn't have – Renton Police didn't have their own polygraph, so they had to take him to Seattle, to the Seattle Police Polygraph Unit. And the guy that was the polygraph operator, his name was Dewey Gillespie. You know, by the time they get downtown – or going to come downtown, it's like 4:30 in the afternoon, and they show up there, and they Gillespie's gone. He's gone for the day. And so one of the other people there says, all right, we can get a hold of him. And they said, why don't you guys go on out and get him something to eat, because Gary was acting really nervous. So they took him to a Jack in the Box or something, and they got him a hamburger, and they chit-chatted and talked about everything in the world, nothing to do with the murder. And then finally, like 6:30 or 7 o'clock, they're back in the Seattle Police Headquarters building. And they introduce him to Gillespie, and Gillespie takes him in the office, and he starts talking to him about the polygraph. And then when you have a polygraph test, there's always what's called a pre-interview, and where the operator asks a bunch of questions of the person they're going to examine, where they're not hooked up to the machine. And they're in the process of this pre-interview when Gary just starts crying. And a minute later, Gillespie opens the door and walks out to the detectives, and he says, Gary just confessed to me that he killed those two boys. They said, oh, my God, you know, they didn't know. So they, you know, they brought him out. And they're talking to him again, and he gives a complete confession. Everything, he describes what he did. He denies, he goes, I can't believe I did this. I like little boys. I like kids. He denies ever sexually touching them, which, you know, is not true, but he denies it.
Right.
Anyway, they go through this whole thing. By this time, it's like 10:30 at night. And then Gillespie comes out and says, let me talk to him again. So they put Gary back in the room. They close the door, and Gillespie just says to him, I'm thinking of a girl by the river. And Gary says, did she have long, dark hair? Was she stabbed? A minute later, he opens the door and he says, in the middle of the conversation, he switches. She had reddish hair. It was in a bob. Blah, 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 blah. And a minute later, Gillespie opens the door and he tells him, he just confessed to killing Carol Erickson and Joanne Zuloff. And now they can't believe it. You know, they're like, oh, my God. So they put him in a They start interrogating about Erickson, get that whole story. They call the county, because the Zuloff case is a King County case, and they get one of the sergeants up, on his way up there, you know. So they end up talking, and they did a good job of interrogating, because, you know, Gary would hold back information, and they would not give him the information. They made him say it, and he would say, claim he didn't remember this or didn't remember that, but he did. And he eventually, you know, that's the key. You can't just say, did you do this and do this? And have the guy go, yeah. Did you do this? Yeah. That's how a false confession happens. You got to let him tell you the facts, right? You don't just sit there and let him regurgitate to you what you're saying. So, and they did a good job, because he tried to have them do that. He wasn't trying as a tactic. That was just his, he didn't want to talk about it that much. But they got him to say the things they needed to say. And then, so then they have this issue. They sent him back, took him to Renton and put him in the Renton City Jail overnight. Because they already got a guy charged with a murder, so they hold him as a material witness to murder at first.
Right.
And so that's what they do. They put him in jail. And that's when he gets a lawyer, and that's when all the other stuff happens.
So this is when the – so tell us about the recording devices and who – this is the initiative of who?
Yeah, well, there's the captain of the detectives. His name was Bill Frazee. He, unbeknownst to anybody at all, not these detectives – only he knew, he had wired a room for recording and recorded everything that happened in there. And I don't know why he did it or what he thought, but he did. And he didn't, and it, and it, in Washington, you can't do that. First of all, you have to have it. Both people have to be aware they're being recorded unless you have a court order. And so he did this, and it's bad enough as far as, you know, the detectives talking to the people in the room, but Gary Grant was talking to his attorney in this room, and their conversation was recorded. And as it ended up later, we found out John Chance had also been talking to his attorney in the room, and his conversation had been recorded, which is absolutely unbelievable, because that jeopardizes the entire case, the whole case. The whole case could go south. A serial killer could walk out the door because of that mistake. And so that was the first part of the mess. And, you know, when that came out, first of all, they had a guy in jail charged who wasn't the killer. That was the first thing. And then second of all, they got these recordings. And so that, you know, sent the prosecutor's office into damage control mode. And they were spinning around. And first thing they did is insulated the prosecutor's office completely from any of the recordings. They didn't want any of those recordings heard by anybody in their office, which was the smart thing to do. And they actually brought in a special prosecutor from the attorney general's office to deal with the recording. And they actually charged the Clinton captain with unlawful wiretapping.
Right. So what eventually or soon after is announced regarding the charges against Chance?
Okay, yeah, so they have a big press release, and they say, yeah, we're dismissing the case against John Chance and releasing him. They dismiss with prejudice, means he could never be charged again. But, yeah, we're dropping all the charges against John Chance. We're charging this Renton captain with unlawful wiretapping or wiretapping ordinances. And then they announce the arrest of the charge of Gary Grant for the four murders that happened. And so everybody, it was a minefield. Like I said, then they had to deal with in court in the pretrial how to get around this recorded conversation. And that was a big, you know, that was a big issue. And matter of fact, I talked to the elected prosecutor, Chris Bailey. When I talked to him contemporaneous now, he said, I couldn't believe that a police commander would do that, would not know that you can't do that. You know, we have it, when I was at Seattle, we have interrogation rooms that are recorded, right? And you tell the person you're being recorded. But if a lawyer comes in there, we switch the recording off while the lawyer's talking. Once the lawyer's out, we switch it back on, because you cannot record a private conversation between a defendant and his attorney. It's terrible thing.
It seemed like, too, you had the two detectives from Renton, and you had the chief deputy prosecutor in a car, and he just overheard them talking about a conversation that they must have heard. Yeah, so the police chief and the two detectives were oblivious that this was wrong.
Right, yeah, that's exactly. They didn't know you couldn't do that, apparently. Again, this is a small agency with not a lot of, you know, most of the stuff they handled was routine stuff, you know, teenagers getting a little out of control. I mean, the detectives probably handled a lot of burglaries or thefts, and, you know, they never handled anything on this level. So, I mean, this was a career case for them. There's no doubt about it, but they learned, you know, and the case was risked. The whole case was at risk. Unfortunately, it didn't end up going away.
You talk about, you write about May 17th, and Grant's first psychological evaluation is this Dr. George Harris, a four-hour session.
Yeah.
What did they get from that about his background and just about motivation for these crimes? And what was his end deduction in terms for the courts?
He went through four psychological evals. But he said, you're talking about the one with Harris? He said which doctor?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, basically, Grant described his home life, which was, he said, was very terrible. His mother had a real drinking problem, and he said, and other people confirmed it. And when she drank, she would become very violent. And she and his father, Glenn Grant, would get in these big fights, and he would the mother would throw things across the room, and his father basically would leave for weeks at a time. And he talked about how they would be you know, he couldn't handle it. And he went to the, Grant had gone into the military, and he got kicked out in basic training. And he said, he claimed because there was a commanding officer there that was cruel to him and did all this stuff, but they said he sent him home because he was a mama's boy and he couldn't handle it.
Excuse me.
Anyway, so basically they went through this whole time. You know, they talked about Glenn's about the kids and how why he would do this. He did, you know, what did he do? He didn't have any suicidal intent. He was he remembered what he said when the word he described when talking about the murders. He would say, "When I close my eyes, I can see the victims. I can see the boys, and I can see like it were a camera." Matter of fact, that's what I wanted to name the book, "When I Close My Eyes," because that was such a, I thought that was a pretty powerful thing. I don't specifically remember doing it, but when I close my eyes, I can see all these things happening. And he described that. He did that with a lot, with more than one psychologist. So, I mean, and then, you know, he was, he said he liked kids. He can't believe he would hurt the kids. But the doctor said, you know, he's obviously got issues, but they thought he was able to stand trial. So three of the four doctors said he was eligible to stand trial and could assist in his defense. One did not. One thought he could not.
It was interesting, too, in this, we didn't mention this, but at the second crime scene with Joanne Zuloff, this crime scene was a little bit different than in that there was a couple things missing in terms of jewelry.
Oh, right, yeah.
Right. And then it's interesting to find out what happened to that piece of jewelry.
Right. Well, so yeah, she was missing a watch, and I forgot what else. It was something else she was missing. But anyway,
earring.
She was missing a watch. Yeah, an earring. That's right. And so, which you know, it's not uncommon for serial killers to take trophies, but Gary was with he hung out with this group of people. And he was kind of an odd duck, but he hung out. There was a guy who was kind of the popular guy in school that everybody liked, named Frank. And he hung out with Frank, and Frank kind of took him under his wing and helped him. And they were at parties all the time. And he had a girlfriend, and he kept telling his girlfriend all the things he did. And she goes, "But you never have any money. You don't get paid for all this stuff." And one time they were at a party, and he hands his girlfriend a watch, and he says, "See, I do get paid for what I do." And he gave her a watch. It ended up being Joanne Zuloff's watch. So, which again, is not uncommon for killers to give trophies to other women or things like that. But he did that. And, you know, you can tie a couple things. Like when they talked to this guy, Frank, he said he had talked about his relationship with Gary. He says, "You know, Gary, I just kind of felt sorry for him. And he was a friend. I hung out with him." He says, there's only one time we ever got in a fight. We got in an argument. I mean, we got in this big yelling argument, you know, and I could tell he was hurt. So I told him I was sorry. And we made up over that night. It was fine by the end of the night, but that ended up being the night before he killed those two little boys. So that's a stressor in his life, you know. And another time he said he got in a fight with his parents and left was just before he killed Joanne Zuloff. So if you look, at least he says the stressor. Now this is all taking his word at that. Well, the other one with Frank was Frank's word. So that's probably true. But, you know, it's ironically the day I got an email, the day this book published, and it was an incredible email. The first day it came out, a lady emailed me. She said, "I always wondered if anybody knew what happened to Gary Grant. So I Googled Gary's name and I saw you wrote a book about it and it's coming out." She goes, "I knew Gary when I was in school. Since we would go, one time we all went up to Crystal Mountain, which is a ski resort near here, because they had a Korean exchange student who'd never seen snow. So they took her up there and Gary was up there with them. And she said, I sat next to Gary and I just got the creeps. I didn't really know him, but I got the creeps. I more knew the other people. And every time he talked to me, he was just weird. And then I found out later that it was a serial killer, and it just freaks me out. And it was just ironic that she just happens to, the day before this book is being published, run his name because all these years she never knew. But that's what everybody said. He was an odd duck. You know, he was like a odd man out. You know, he kind of kept to himself. If he told a joke, he would look at Frank. And if Frank laughed, he would laugh. But if Frank didn't, he wouldn't laugh. So he was just kind of a little wounded puppy dog. Although, you know, if you look at this picture, he's a strapping, good-looking young man, you know.
Yeah.
He had movie star looks, you know. He doesn't anymore, I tell you that. I saw his picture in prison, but he did then. He was, you know, he had a lot going for him, except for his, you know, obviously psychological issues.
Yeah. Tell us about the trial. And it's interesting, too, as you talk about a friend, Edmund Allen Jr., was six years old at the time. But his
right.
father was helped prosecuting this case. So Edmund Allen, his father, was part of the prosecution team. What did they try to do? What was the strategy that they had and maybe only had in terms of trying to defend Gary Grant?
The defense? Well, the defense's only issue, because the state sought the death penalty, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the defense's only job, because there was no way they're going to get him off, although they tried,
no.
of course, but there's no way they're going to get him off. So their only thing is to save his life. And so they went through the thing and tried to paint him, you know, sympathetic to the jury as they possibly could, you know, because he'd done these terrible, you know, killed these little boys and then the two girls that were just young teenagers. And, you know, it's a horrendous crime. But then you got to get this. And they put him on the stand himself. And apparently he just, one of the prosecutors told me, he got up there and he just kind of was in a trance. As a matter of fact, his testimony was so strange that the state did not even cross him. They didn't feel they needed to because they thought they'd given it all up. And the other thing that was odd about the trial was the defense, who fought so hard to have this case dismissed because of the recording with his previous attorney, actually played that recording in the trial in front of the jury. So I'm not sure what they were thinking with that. You know, I don't know. But in the end, you know, they did. He was quickly found guilty. Then he was he did not receive the death penalty. So then the other mm-hmm. only other issue becomes how much time he served, because under the sentencing laws back then, he could have gotten like 8 or 9 years and been released, because, you know, if they gave him life, because they could run him consecutively. But again, yeah, there's no way. I talked to the judge in this case. There was no way they were going to do that. So he ended up getting, you know, 4 life sentences, and, you know, the minimum he could do was like 100 years or something. It all worked out in the end, but they tried real hard, and he couldn't easily, you know, if it'd been a little bit different system, a little judge, you're going to let this guy walk. And, you know, one thing about this guy is he's going to kill again if he gets out. There's no question about it.
Yeah, and the thing is, you were right that there was a chance that the judge could have sentenced him to a concurrent sentence, which would have meant that it would have acted like just one sentence and could have had a parole out of that potentially. So,
right, yeah, and the numbers were much lower than they are now. You know, now in Washington State, if you commit a violent crime felony, you have to do 85% of the crime. You can only get 15% off for good time, but it was like 50% back then. You know, and so it could have been a much lower sentence.
Yeah, effectively. Yeah. You talk about him in prison in Walla Walla, Washington. What was his fate once there? You talk about an author that he corresponded with for 4 years.
Right. Yeah. Who just stumbled upon him herself, you know, And so I got her book because I heard about it. I got her book and I read the things and I cited her thing. It ends up we have mutual friends. I've never met this author, but I know people who know her well. But he intimated that his mother had sexually molested him at some point. I don't know. Mm-hmm. She may have. I mean, there's no question. There is no question this guy had a terrible childhood, right? But a lot of people have terrible childhoods and don't go on killing people in their lives. But yeah, and he had a lot of issues. And actually, I just found out he's been transferred to Monroe, which is over on the – Walla Walla is way on the other side of the mountains, and Monroe is closer to Seattle. He got transferred there recently, but that's where he is right now because they moved him around after a while. But he's 50 years, you know, 50 years since he did the murder, and he's 51 now almost, so he's still
in prison. Yeah, but it seemed pretty disingenuous, some of the claims that he had in those letters, claimed to not remember crimes. Also claimed to not have raped people that were proven to be raped. So
you
can't take too much. What are you saying?
Yeah, right, exactly. And, you know, I have friends that are criminologists that talk do these things where they exchange things with serial killers. One of my friends was doing Manson, Kenneth Bianchi, and all these guys, and they all want to, you know, give make themselves look better than they are and deny things, and of course, you know, they want things from you talking to them. So you got to take it with a grain of salt. I mean, not to say there's not some intellectual value in it, but you have to take everything with a grain of salt.
Absolutely. I want to thank you very much, Cloyd, for coming on and talking about your book, Seattle's Forgotten Serial Killer, Gary Jean Grant. It's been fascinating. For those that people might want to check out this book, or do you have a Facebook page, Amazon page? Tell us about how people might take a look at this work.
Well, it's on. I do have an Amazon page. I have a Facebook page, and I have my own website, cloydsteiger.com, CloydSteiger.com. It's also available in some bookstores, probably just in this region, though, but it's in bookstores here, but I don't know about other places. But you can get it on Amazon or Target or, you know, everybody. Pretty much anywhere that sells books sells it.
Absolutely. Thank you very much, Cloyd. It's been a pleasure. Seattle's Forgotten Serial Killer, Gary Jean Grant. Thank you very much. You have a great evening.
You too. Thanks, Dan.
Thank you. Good night.
Good night.